Holm's line of foldable panels are perfect for portable ham radio activities, from soda to field day. PowerFilm solar panels are thin film, light, and flexible. These solar panels are a fraction of the size and weight of conventional rigid panels. Check them out at powerfilmsolar.com.
This week, we are honored to bring Eric Swartz, WA6HHQ. You guys may recognize that name, as Eric is one half of the founders of Elecraft. And I'm sad to tell you folks, Eric is not here to announce a new Elecraft DMR radio.
Darn.
Hello, Eric. How are you?
Hey, guys, doing great. How are you doing today?
Doing good. So it's really great to finally get a chance to have you on the show. You know, we're going to be answering some very basic questions that even me as a ham who is coming up on my 10-year anniversary next year, things around receiver performance and overall radio design features that, you know, they're in every spec sheet for every radio. There are lists on the internet that compare radios by these things. And I think oftentimes we get excited about these specs, but I can honestly say for myself that there's a lot of them I don't know what they actually mean.
No, it's scary. There's so many of them there, and it's overwhelming. I know back before I got into radio design is that part of it. I have an engineering background, and I was looking at radios and saying, why do I want to buy this radio? And usually the most common thing, someone said, hey, it's really quiet. And you know, that didn't tell me too much, but we actually bought radios back 30, 40 years ago based on how quiet they were, and we thought that meant they were sensitive. So there's a lot more to it than that, and I've certainly gotten dug into it quite a bit over the last 20 years here in this part of the business. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, before we jump into that, why don't you give us just a very brief introduction to you and your ham career?
Oh, gosh. I'm a Silicon Valley guy. I went to school in degree in electrical and electronics and a little bit of computer science thrown in for good measure, mostly from the instrumentation and test side of the world. And then I also did a lot of digital stuff in Silicon Valley and then went crazy and started a ham radio business with Wayne Burdick and 6KR coming up on 20 years now. This is our 20th year of operations. So we started Elecraft. Actually, I think we shipped our first product January of 99 that we were working on it. In 98, which is sort of when I count the starting of the company, because I went full-time back then in June of 98. But we actually started even working on it, you know, on the side a couple of years before that. So we started the company, and I back up even earlier. I got my ham license back in 1971. So this is my – I'm giving away my age a little bit here almost. I'm 47 years in ham radio, so I'm not on Medicare yet. But, of course, running a ham radio company might put me there faster than No, it's been a lot of fun, and as a great hobby, that's what got me into electronics and as an engineer and a business person, and did some other companies before Elecraft, and then got crazy and started a ham radio business that I thought I would never start, and we've had to blast the last 20 years, and it's been a lot of fun producing both really fun-to-use radios and high-performance radios.
So I think one of the things that's remarkable about your company is that you guys are constantly coming out with new products and really innovative designs. I think the first thing that I recognized way back when was some of the early designs that Wayne did that were super low power consumption and really good performance and really what I would call an elegant design. And I guess, is that where Elecraft, where the name Elecraft comes from?
Yeah, it was Elegant Craft. And the first radio, the K2 that Wayne and I designed together, was a classic Heathkit style. You solder all the parts together on the circuit board and build it up. So we were looking for a name you could remember that didn't have too many syllables and stood out. And after going through about 100, Elecraft bubbled to the top. And, of course, we've been called Electrocraft and Electrocraft and so on. But I think by now, actually, most people sort of know it's Elecraft. I used to have a pronunciation guide on the website over in the left-hand corner. You know, how do you say Elecraft? But yeah, that's how it came about, and we still sell a lot of our radios as kits, and we certainly offer, except for the K2, which we still sell. That's kit only. Almost everything else is kit or factory built, so they can go both directions if you don't have the time to build it or don't want to build a second or third copy. If you're beefing up your contest station, you can buy it built too.
So now the product line is pretty broad between portable radios and more conventional home station kind of radios, amplifiers, tuners, up and down converters for VHF and just so many different things. So what's new? What's new in the last, say, 6 to 12 months from Elecraft?
Well, last 6 to 12 months, and I know you guys had David Schoaf on here talking about the KPA 1500. That's been our newest product. That's a fully solid state pin diode switch, no relays clicking when you go from transmit to receive, 1500 watt plus amplifier. And it's pretty cool. We've actually been shipping those now for several months, and we're pumping them out the door as fast as we can. It's a nice high performance unit. It's small enough that it can actually has two pieces to it. It's got a RF deck that'll sit on your desktop and will not break your back to pick up, and a switching power supply with very quiet fans on it that you can stick on the floor if you want, or over on the side, and basically keep your desk space under control. But that's the one that's been keeping us busy. My biggest problem right now is shipping them fast enough so I don't get lynched by the mob that bought them on the first couple of days. But they've been very patient, and we've been catching up and ramping our rate up and working through that. That's probably the newest thing out there. I won't go into much more detail on it because I know you guys have covered that in the previous episodes, but that's been a new product for us. It's done extremely well. We continue. You know, one thing that people don't realize is all of our radios sort of evolve. When we come out with a K3 and then a K3S, and of course the KX3, and then we added a lot of things to the KX3, like the PX3 pan adapter or the KX2. Each one of those, in addition to software, we keep updating and adding features a lot of times that at user suggestions or our own ideas to evolve that radio over time and provide that for free. We also add pieces to those products and give more functionality to them over time. So the K3 that comes off the manufacturing line today, or K3S in this case, is not the same as the original K3Ss or even the original K3s. They all evolve. Nothing's wrong with the earlier radios as we keep adding new things to them and certainly new features that you can add on to them. So it's been a lot of fun. So I'd say, watch even our existing products as we keep adding fun things to them to make them more useful to you guys.
You know, I was going to say, I'll add a comment about that, because one of the, so I own basically the KX3 line. I've got the KX3, the pan adapter, the 100 watt amp. And one of the things that I actually love is my radio has been back to you. It was a relatively early serial number, and there were several small revisions or updates. And it was really awesome that I could basically send the radio back, and covering the cost of a couple of parts for certain things and then shipping back, you guys took my radio and basically had performed all the changes that had happened to date. And I mean, that's an incredible thing. I mean, the radio, it just keeps iteratively getting better month after month. Yeah, between that and the firmware updates.
Absolutely. Yeah, if people want to do that, we absolutely will do it for them. You know, if it's something that actually fixes a major problem that crops up, generally we don't charge for that, and ship it into us, and we'll ship it back to you at our cost and fix it. Fortunately, those don't happen very often. But and the upgrades in terms of, hey, we found a way to even improve performance further, or the kind of things you were looking at, we make it pretty affordable. We can't turn a K3 into a K3S by itself economically. That costs too much. If you asked us to change all the boards in it, you'd better off buying a new radio. But what we did do for people even on that, we said, hey, you can buy some of the pieces of it, upgrade the synthesizers for quieter noise, or upgrade the I/O to add a USB sound card interface, things like that. But rather than doing the whole radio, actually the most economical thing to do is to send us their old radio. We call it a migration. And we will take their old K3, pull out the boards that are appropriate to move over into the new K3. Their filters, for instance, which you can spend a lot of money on. So why not use those over? And we give them back two radios. They had to buy a stripped down K3S, and then we move those over and they add anything else they want to it. And they get that and fully configured the way they want. And then we give them back their K3 fully tested. Useful for the backup radio or something they can go to eBay with and offset the cost of the K3S. So that was a way to do it with the big radios. But like you said, on the KX3 and all the other radios, including K3s and K3Ss, as we add more smaller changes to them over time, or other small internal boards like the synthesizer is a good example. We let people migrate that back to earlier radios. And in the case of the new synth that we put in the K3S, it was quiet and did a lot of neat stuff. We let people put those in the K3s. So it's a hybrid sometimes, but the whole thing is that the radio keeps evolving and you have a lot of fun with it, which has been a major advantage for us over a lot of radios out there that are sort of, once you got it, that's what you got.
Well, it's sort of funny listening, reading some of the postings on the email reflectors on like the KX3 mailing list. I'll see somebody will post a message like, boy, I wish that the KX3 did this. some, you know, behavior in the, in the radio. And then Wayne will make a comment like, "Oh, that's an interesting idea. I'll think about that." And then like 3 months later, like it's in the next firmware release.
There's a double-edged sword, because we do try to do that. We actually do pay attention to the email list, though. Just because someone said it on there doesn't mean that we did hear it, because there'll be times we'll miss it. It's not like a formal submission process, but we try to at least add them to a potential list, and then we pick and choose, because obviously we can't do everything. There's just such a flood of ideas that come in, but we do try to do a few from time to time. Sometimes we're constrained by either code space or even resources, you know, how many people time we have to work on stuff versus new designs. But we want to keep the radios live and interesting as long as we can. And so far, it's worked out pretty well, and people have been pretty happy about what we've added into them.
Well, you do hear a lot about talk about support. And I think all of the ham radio manufacturers, the big ones, are all pretty good as far as support goes, has been my experience. But I think you guys have done a particularly outstanding job in both timeliness and thoroughness. I had a similar experience where with my K2, I was one of the what did you call them? Like the early adopter?
Oh, field testers.
Field tester, yeah. So I had one of the first 100 K2s. And by the time I built it all up and it was fine. And then a few years later, there are several mods. There are probably 20 little hardware tweaks and changes. And I didn't want to bother doing it myself, so I just sent it back. And your guys just, you know, made all the mods, and it was a very reasonable price for doing all that stuff. And I was just grateful that you guys were willing to do it, so I didn't have to mess around with it myself. So that was great.
Yeah, support's really an important thing. It's something in any business I've been involved with where I had a say in it, that we actually overspent, if anything, on support, both because we want to help you solve as a customer problem, so you get up and have fun with the radio as fast as possible. We don't want you frustrated, even if it's not our fault per se. Sometimes people call us up thinking it's our radio with the problem and it's something else in their system. I see it right now with the 1500 watt amplifiers. I get someone say, "Hey, you know, I have this antenna I've been using for years, and when I turn your amp up over 500 watts, all of a sudden your amp goes offline. What's happening here?" And of course, it turned out they had a Balun that was underpowered and it was arcing or something like that. But all this up, and our guys talked to them and worked through, say, "Hey, here's what's happening. We think try this. And they figured it out and they were able to get their cells up and running. And that's not something that's directly focused on, "Gee, what's wrong with my K3 or my KX3, that kind of question. It's more, how do we solve the problem for you? And we try to do that as much as we can. We're not a general resource, of course. We try to keep it a little bit related to our products. But I think we get a lot of goodwill from people that way, too, by doing a good job there. And it comes back and it benefits us somewhere down the road, too. So we keep that going, because I think it's a very important.
Well, and one other comment on that, though, too, is it's not just support. I mean, it's actually even community involvement. I mean, you know, as I was waiting in the initial batch, you know, having ordered and the backlog of KX3s, just constantly participating in some of the online forums, and it's not just some folks on your staff. Like Wayne himself was actually participating and taking feedback and giving responses, as well as other members of the Elecraft team. And I'm just not used to that as a consumer, that the owners of the company are actually that involved. That really shows a high level of engagement.
Yeah, we're both active out there. Of course, the internet makes that even easier than it used to be in the past. You'll see both Wayne and I talking a lot of places, and some of our other people popping up too, either under their Elecraft email address or their own personal addresses. Some of our engineers pop up on the list, sometimes without their Elecraft address, so people don't quite realize who they are, so they don't get flooded with emails, but they'll be answering questions for people and things like that. And other times they'll say exactly who they are, which is sort of cool. And that's how we get feedback and get ideas and stuff. Plus we're still involved in the hobby too, even though we do it, you know, all day too. We have a lot of fun with it. So it's a social thing for us too, to some extent, but obviously a lot of work in there too, to get all these things out the door.
Well, so obviously we're big fans of your work and very thankful. I mean, I've had the pleasure of using the KX3 for my last three major, either field days or winter field days, and have loved it. But, you know, we could sit here and talk about Elecraft all day long, but I really want, and I feel that there's no better person than I could ask to get an understanding of, when we're looking at a radio, you know, if you were a ham in the old days, you had a separate box on your desk for transmission and a separate box on your desk for reception. And we take it for granted that we have these combined devices today that we call transceivers. And at the end of the day, the one of the lessons I think I have always learned and picked up is that the more important of those two tends to be the receiver. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think they're both important. The cleanliness of the transmitter certainly is important too. But the receiver, if you don't have a good receiver and you can't, you know, you've heard that phrase, if you can't hear them, you can't work them. And that's true. And so usually the quality of the receiver, obviously on your side, the antennas that you can put up the best you can with whatever your constraints are. So it's a lot of fun to squeeze as much as you can out of limited constraints. I've done that for years in past places I used to live and are operating portable. Certainly you can't always put up a huge tower and big antenna and still have a blast. I'd say the receiver and antenna are both probably the key thing. Obviously transmitter is important and depending on what you want to do, if you're into hi-fi ham radio, obviously, or ESSB, things like that, the transmit fidelity is very important too. But it does come back to the receiver. So you see a lot of radios ranked by receiver side, but because the transmitter side, they're much more parallel to each other. And so you'll see much bigger spread in radio performance on the receive side.
You know, and the other side of this too is I think, again, if we look at a lot of the questions that are in the question pool at the, you know, the general or extra level, you know, there's some content in there in the study guides about talking about receiver design and topology. And now, you know, here we are in 2018 and, you know, the technology is starting to shift, right? I mean, you now hear more and more frequently about software-defined radios or SDRs, which, you know, is based on one type of receiver technology versus pretty much every other HF radio made for quite some time up until this recent era. When we look at these things, again, we're really interested in understanding what these specs are. But at a high level, what are the common receiver designs and kind of what's the difference?
Okay. Yeah, I can talk about probably the two things because they're interrelated here. What are the receiver designs out there? And also, what are the specifications that are important? Because that's why we have different receiver designs to some extent. We're highlighting different areas we're trying to improve or make better in the radio. Before I get into the receiver architecture, could I touch, without getting too overblown, you can stop me if I get too techy, just covering maybe three or four of the key things from receiver performance standpoint that are important.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Explain why they're important. I mean, that's the key thing is why do you care about all these things? And
yeah, because I mean, we read a spec sheet and we hear about third order intercept point or blocking dynamic range. And while those sound really important, I honestly can't. George, you probably know exactly what they are, but it's my job to be the neophyte on the show. And so I don't know what that means or how it affects me or how to optimize those things. So I absolutely would love to know what are some of those specs, what do they mean, and in which direction is good, you know, higher or lower.
Yeah, I think so. I'll go briefly over them here, and feel free to put the hook around my neck if I get too far down the path. But I'd say when you're looking at receivers, I mean, certainly sensitivity, everybody wants a receiver that can hear really weak signals. And the trick is, what does that really mean when you're in a real world where you can either have nobody around you living nearby you or field day or contesting with lots of stations on the air or nearby you? Or even broadcast stations, especially over in Europe in the bands. How do you hear that weak signal without having it overwhelmed with other issues from strong signals being nearby? How do you, just even if they aren't super strong signals, filter out the signals you don't want to hear or other things along the lines that can make it tough to hear those weak signals? And obviously, again, fidelity and things like that are important too to some extent so that you can hear the important stuff about picking the signal out of the noise. Back when I was first getting in ham radio, you know, we want a sensitive radio. And guys would talk about noise floor. And you would say, what's noise floor with a radio? And basically what people were talking about is what's the internal noise generated inside the radio. And we all thought if the radio was really, really quiet, like if you took the antenna off the radio and the radio went super quiet, that was going to be a really good radio and be able to hear weak signals. Well, maybe so, maybe not. I can take a totally deaf radio. Think about a radio that has an attenuator in the front end turned on, and I unplug the antenna. And if the radio is a fairly quiet design internally, yes, it'll get really quiet. But you plug the antenna back in, you may not be able to hear the weak signals because it still doesn't have enough amplification in the receiver chain to actually amplify those weak signals up too. So there's a trade-off there in terms of how it works. So just looking at a radio overall, I think that you're looking at sensitivity. We talk about the sensitivity of a radio, and I'll define that a little more for you in a second. We talk about, and you hear this phrase all the time, and people's eyes gloss over if they're not familiar with it, a dynamic range. And there's a couple different types of dynamic range. What does that mean? It's strong signal handling is what it means. There's strong signals nearby you when you're trying to receive a weak one. But I'll talk about two different kinds of dynamic range. One's called third order intermodulation dynamic range, IMD3, and one's called blocking dynamic range. And don't go to sleep yet. I'll make it real simple and I won't go very long. But those two are important too. And then certainly how good the radio can filter stuff just with crystal filters or DSP is important too in terms of, if you want a 2.5 kilohertz bandwidth for sideband or you want to have a sharp cutoff to get rid of signals nearby, how much will that buy you versus something a little bit more gentle that might have higher fidelity. But getting back, sensitivity real quick. These days we do measure it, what we call minimum discernible signal, MDS. And that is uniquely tied to two things. It's tied to the noise generated inside the radio from the amplifier stages, and there's always a little bit, and also how much amplification we have in the receive chain that brings the signal up above that natural noise floor so you can hear it. And you can make a radio extremely sensitive, but it will actually degrade another area we're going to talk about in a second, which is this dynamic range where you get overloaded by strong signals. So if you think about it, you put too much amplification in the receive side of a radio, you can say, oh, I've got great sensitivity, but as soon as there's another signal anywhere in the band nearby, if you have too much amplification, that goes into distortion, gets overloaded, and guess what? You get the signal you're listening to covered up. And that shows up traditionally in these two specs we talk about, IMDR3, dynamic range, and that's intermod dynamic range and blocking dynamic range. People would say, what the heck are those things? And again, before I even get on to them, though, I'm sorry. The noise floor thing we're talking about, minimum discernible signal. The simple definition is we basically take a radio that is hooked up to a signal generator, turn the signal generator off, look at what the natural noise coming out of the radio is, and then we start injecting very weak signals and keep increasing that signal strength until we see roughly the signal level coming out of the speaker double. That's 3 decibels in engineering talk. But basically, once you look at that change, the signal generator level that causes that, that's the definition of what we call minimum discernible signal. Your ear actually can hear something a little weaker than that. That's the one we use as defining the sensitivity on a radio. When we talk about dynamic range, and by the way, that's a good number to use. You'll see MDS, minimum discernible signal, listed as minus something, 130 dBm. dB relative to a milliwatt, or minus 135 or minus 120. Now, what does that mean? The basic thing is on most shortwave bands, because we have noise generated in the atmosphere and everything else, you're going to want to have something between the mid minus 120s. And here, bigger numbers are more sensitive. So because they're getting weaker and weaker, means a bigger negative number means you can hear lower and lower signals or smaller and smaller signals. So typically most HF radios can do something between, say, the minus 125 range, which is moderately sensitive, to minus 130, which is quite usable for even when strong signals are present. Maybe you kick your preamp in and you get to minus 135 or minus 138, and that might be more than you need on some of the low frequency bands, but you got some flexibility there with a lot of radios. So those are what those numbers sort of mean, but most radios have enough sensitivity. I'd say 95% of the radios in the market are more than sensitive enough in the general sense for amateur radio use. So I don't panic over that number as long as it's within that reasonable range for what I need to do on it. Dynamic range, I'll just talk about these two real quick. And for folks that have operated on VHF and UHF, but particularly 2 meters FM, you'll understand when I tell you about the parallels to this. If you're talking about intermod, like you have on 2 meters when you go through a large metro area with a lower performance 2 meter repeater radio, and all of a sudden you hear paging systems and other people talking all at the same time coming through your receiver, that's intermodulation. That's where all those strong signals overwhelm the front first amplifier in your radio, the little preamplifier, whatever it is, say in your 2 meter mobile. And that all of a sudden is going into, if you think about going into clipping where it can't amplify anymore, it sort of flat tops the signals, and that turns it into a mixer where it actually now starts creating a bunch of secondary signals we call intermods that show up on different frequencies as a result of all the sums and differences of all the radio signals coming into it. So once it's overloaded, now it's made your radio into a broadband receiver of a whole bunch of different stuff, and you start hearing all that garbage. On shortwave, same thing can happen with a lot of signals on the band. It might just sound like, hey, the band's noisy tonight. You're hearing a lot of more static. You're hearing a lot more little bips and squeaks, squeaks and things like that, but they aren't necessarily coherent voices like you might have with FM stations overlapping each other on a 2-meter radio. But when we talk about third-order intermodulation, just think 2-meter intermod on a radio. If you have that happen, and that'll make sense to you. But basically, it's the additional garbage that gets created in your receiver when there are multiple signals coming into the antenna that are very strong. And the way we test it is test it with very strong signals coming in from a couple of signal generators. In a simple case, two interfering signals, and we space them fairly close to you initially, anywhere from 2 kilohertz away to, say, 10 or 20 kilohertz away. And see, you know, how high we have to crank those up until they generate a signal that covers up this a weak signal inside the receive band. And then the difference between the sensitivity noise floor of your radio, that MDS I mentioned earlier, say it was minus 130, and the level I had to set the signal generators to cause interference that covered up a weak signal inside that, just above that noise floor, that would be the difference between where I had to set the signal generators to and your noise floor is the dynamic range. So if I have to set those signal generators higher and higher to get that covering up of your weak signal with these intermods, that means I have better dynamic range. And so these days, a lot of radios will have in the 90 dB dynamic range, 90 decibels above your noise floor, two signals cranked up really close by to you might start to cover up a weak signal. And by the way, if you have a stronger signal you're listening to, it takes even more, of course. That's reasonable. Good radios are going to be in the mid to high 90s to around 100 dB dynamic range. In some cases, even more. Though in some cases, you don't always need that much more, but it does help in really extreme cases like field day or contesting. The other dynamic range, and I'll be real quick on this one, is blocking dynamic range. This is just one signal causing your receiver sort of to fold up and not be able to receive weak signals. And this is actually overloading in a different way, where in essence it's effectively reducing the gain of the receiver. Again, using the 2-meter parallel, if you're if you're listening on a repeater, you're talking on a repeater, say on 2 meters, you're transmitting on a frequency 600 kilohertz away from where you're receiving. So you're listening to the repeater, and your buddy pulls up next to you who's talking to you, and suddenly everything goes away. He's talking through the repeater, but you can't hear the repeater anymore. What happened? Well, he's not actually transmitting on the repeater output frequency. He's transmitting 600 kilohertz away on its input. But your receiver in your car can't handle that strong of a signal nearby, even if it's that far away in frequency. And all of a sudden, everything just gets really, you know, no matter what you're listening to, it just got crunched like the receiver sensitivity was turned down. And that's desense. And we call it blocking dynamic range on HF. So on shortwave radios, ham radio, on the HF spectrum, that's blocking dynamic range. So just think intermod and desense when you hear IMD dynamic range and blocking dynamic range. And in both cases, similar test, we keep cranking up a single signal for blocking dynamic range until it causes the receiver gain to drop by about a dB or so initially. And that gives us the threshold where that's starting to happen. And we use that to compare different radios. One thing that's been an area we focused on, in addition to having great intermod specs, we've got probably one of the best, if not the best, blocking range, better than almost anything out there, so which makes us work really well on field day and contests for people too. So those are probably the top specmanship numbers you hear thrown around, and of course you can pick any one of those. And there's an old saying, you know, if you want three specifications met, pick two, because if you make them all at their maximum number, it's probably impossible to get to. So for instance, you can make a radio relatively deaf and but still be able to handle strong signals. But, of course, you won't be able to hear the weak signals because you made it deaf. You put the attenuator in the front end, for instance. But in some cases, that doesn't matter because the signals you're going to be listening to are much stronger on your frequency, say down on 160 or 80 meters or 40 meters. And that's where we usually turn off our preamps, and we turn on attenuators sometimes just for that reason. So you have some adjustment in the radios to make them all work. So you'll see a lot of radios compared that way, but that's sort of the basic techie numbers there. Last couple things, filtering, obviously sharp, clean filters, either in DSP or crystals. filtering is very useful in terms of notching out or cutting out signals that are adjacent to you, not that are overloading you, but just that are making noise inside your receiver passband. If you have a very wide receive filter in place and there's somebody nearby in frequency, it makes it hard to listen to the person you want to listen to. But if you can narrow it down where it just cuts them out, but you don't really cut out the person you're listening to, that's very nice. So you can do that with crystal filters. You can do it with DSP filters or a combination of all those. So from a specsmanship, that's the specky side, the techie side.
Let me ask one quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So going back to blocking dynamic range, you threw out some value ranges for the IMDR3 and for the sensitivity number. What are the values you would look for, on average for blocking dynamic range? And is it better to have higher or lower?
And for both blocking dynamic range and IMD dynamic range, the number, and it's a positive number, you want to have it be higher. In the case, by the way, of sensitivity, it's also a higher number, but it's a higher negative number because you're saying, hey, I can hear weaker, weaker, weaker signals as referenced how many dB below a milliwatt. So in each case, if the number looks larger to you, that's usually a good thing. In blocking dynamic range, typically, if you want to have a reasonably good performance with strong signals nearby, you probably want to see something better than 130 dB of blocking dynamic range. Most good radios that are higher performance radios are going to be higher than that, typically in the mid-130s. In some cases, even 140s, the K3S has both extremely sensitive, quiet synthesizers and a sensitive receiver and a very strong front end to where we can handle strong signals. We're up at above 140 in the close space, like signals 2 kilohertz away case. So those are all very important specs. So blocking dynamic range, I'd say, you know, in the -130 or better range, ideally. But again, depends how you're going to use the radio. One thing we didn't touch upon earlier is that I think I'd like to be really clear. I think almost every radio out there is a good radio for different uses in radio. I don't ever want to say something bad about a radio. One, because most of my customers have a lot of our competitors' radios, and they're all pretty cool. There's nothing wrong with them. So you can have a lot of fun with almost any radio out there. But you'll find some radios that are designed for mobile use, and they will have less dynamic range, but you don't care because you're using a small antenna when you're running mobile. Maybe you want to crank up the sensitivity a little bit on it at the sacrifice of dynamic range in a small package, and they do that. It's nice to be able to try to get both of those, but typically if you take that same radio and you use it on field day with three other guys with strong transmitters nearby you, it's not going to be that clean on receive. It's going to get covered up and overloaded. And actually, those tend to also be a little bit noisier on transmit, and they might be wiping out people with broadband transmit noise on field day too. So they're all different, but they're great for mobile use because there you're not going to cause any problems for people because you're running at a lower effective transmit signal and of course receive signal coming into you because of the short antennas.
So just a quick example, let's go back to the field day example. So in a case like field day or a de-expedition or some situation where you have multiple radios, for these different specs, which is the most critical spec to look at to try to keep my buddy's station out of my receiver? So if we're running, let's say, 40 and 20 meters, and I'm hearing the key clicks or I'm hearing some bleed over and sideband, what spec would I have looked for to have a receiver which would have done a better job of getting his signal out of my passband?
Yeah, there's actually two things probably. I mean, they all come into play, but assuming you guys have your sensitivity or you've set up whether you're using a preamp properly or so on for your particular band that you're on. I'd say first, on a receiver standpoint, if you've got two guys in the same band, like you were saying, like sideband and CW on one band, is that what you were saying?
Well, I was thinking I've been at field day where we were just getting interference across between bands, let alone in the same band. But let's go with both of those, say, 20-40, and I'm still hearing something bleed through, or let's say within only 20, sideband CW, so we're much closer, but still getting some interference.
Yeah, they're both a challenge. Inside the same band, there's two things that come into play. Because generally, you're looking at just, for the most part, in terms of really, really, really crazy strong signals, because you're transmitting physically nearby each other on field day or in a contest, multi-contest situation. Blocking dynamic range is going to come into play there a lot, where that signal, if it's really strong, can start causing the receiver to basically reduce its sensitivity. And the guy is listening to a weak signal, all of a sudden it disappears and he goes, where'd it go? It wasn't covered up, it just went away when the other guy's transmitting. Correspondingly, the cleanliness of the transmitter is important too. You hear another spec thrown around a lot called phase noise, and that's the cleanliness in terms of of the local oscillator that we use, the VFO in the VFO oscillators in the case of an analog radio, or the cleanliness of the crystal local master oscillator in a pure DSP radio, and all the stages that handle that later on in terms of whether they introduce some jitter in that signal. Jitter being, think about it, noise being added on top of the signal, I guess is the best way of putting it. In both of those cases, both on transmit and receive, can cause you to transmit broadband noise. And that mobile radio I mentioned earlier, a lot of the smaller mobile radios will have much noisier transmit oscillators than, say, a high-end desktop radio. And again, it doesn't matter when you're mobile running 100 watts because no one's going to care, but they're going to care if you're running 1.5 kilowatts just a few hundred yards from somebody. So that transmit phase noise is important. On receive, by the way, that same noise in the receive oscillators can mix off frequency with signals, again, that you're not tuned to and raise your noise floor when they're there. So that's another one. Getting a little deeper than I wanted to on that, but that's one area. So getting back, I'd say blocking dynamic range, again, desense, is the one you're going to get when you have really strong guys right next to you. Intermod is one where you have multiple people, and even on the different bands thing can happen here, George, where there's different types of intermod where the signals can be inside the same band with you generating the intermod signal, or they can be on multiple bands that maybe are harmonically related. Mm-hmm. And not looking at their transmit, you know, second 2x of their frequency, but also looking at just how they overload the front of the radio and how well it filters out of band stuff. We work hard on that. We actually have band specific ham radio only filters on our front ends of most of our, like our K3s and K3s, to prevent that as much as possible. So those are all pretty important things, but that's probably as much as I want to get into before we put the guys to sleep, I think.
But you know, actually, Eric, you brought up something that really makes a lot of sense to me, that it's the performance of the receiver to try to keep the other guy out of your receiver, but it's just as important for the other guy to have a clean transmitter.
Yeah.
So to like the earlier point that you guys made in the very beginning, which is that it's important to have a good transmitter and a good receiver, depending on the situation. So I would imagine that some of these specs would not be very critical at your home station. So if I don't have any hams around me, I don't have any big RF sources around me, maybe the blocking spec or the phase noise spec, doesn't really matter a whole lot. But if I'm at field day or in any situation with multiple receivers and transmitters, then all of a sudden this stuff starts to become pretty important.
Yeah, to a large extent, that you can say that's true. Certainly, again, you can have fun with any radio almost any time. And then you start pushing the performance envelope a little bit and you find out, oh, I want to upgrade it or change it. I'd say the couple of the things that are important there is if you're on lower frequencies, you got a lot more strong signals, even if they're right not next door to you. 40 meters, 80 meters, 160, you see that a lot, either with ham signals nearby or ones from broadcast stations, especially over in Europe. That's a big deal with a lot of the shortwave stations nearby. Interesting comment, by the way, though. Even with nobody nearby you, this crazy phase noise spec we were talking about. Again, phase noise, think about it as a perfect oscillator. If you looked at it in a spectrum analyzer, it'd be an infinitely thin vertical line with no noise sidebands going off to infinity plus and minus from that signal. Of course, no oscillator is perfect, so you'll see, usually it looks sort of like an inverted V, where your main signal at the top of the screen is what you want to have for the noise, the signal source in your radio on receive, and also on transmit. And then as you get further and further away from it, you'll see a noise fairly close to its top level signal, real close to it. And then as you get further away, that drops down and goes down towards the noise floor of the radio further away from that.
Are you really seeing variability in the frequency of the oscillator? Is that?
Yeah, does that. I mean, you're basically seeing, if you look at a voice transmit, we have a certain bandwidth to our voice when we talk because we're mixing with a single carrier, if you want to think about it this way, or lack of carrier and sideband where a carrier would be, you're taking all your audio and you'll see all those audio sidebands, on AM plus and minus from the signal. In the case of noise, it's the same thing. It's just like you're modulating it with noise. Now, it's not very much noise, but when you have strong signals, it becomes important. Now, but one other case I was going to point out, this is interesting. So just think of it this way. You've got some component of noise that when you tune your oscillator, you're also tuning this noise spectra that moves around with you, plus or minus from where you're listening out many kilohertz. And again, the further away, it usually gets weaker and weaker and weaker. We had very quiet radio phase noise design on the K3, the original K3 we did in 2007. People love it, still do to this day, nothing wrong with it. When we did the K3S, we made a breakthrough and came up with a new synthesizer, local oscillator synthesizer, if you want to call it that, that we tuned the radio with, that especially within 10 kilohertz of the radio was a 10 to 15 dB quieter. We pushed down that noise even further, and it was very quiet to start with. People said, why do you do that? Why is it important? And we were thinking both transmit when you have nearby signals transmit, or also nearby signals on receive, that noise that your oscillator has, even on receive, can mix with those signals and then put them inside your passband, just like you were tuned to that frequency. So your noise floor would go up. You wouldn't hear a discrete signal necessarily, but you hear or something like that if someone's on CW or some mix of things otherwise. So it made it quieter that way. So, but one thing we didn't expect, and here's the one that I wanted to point out, George, is that we had people starting to tell us, hey, your radio is quieter on 80 and 160 at night. And I go, really? Because you can't hear a noise floor in a radio normally when you have an antenna hooked up to it, because the band noise is well above that. And I was not, you know, also, it's, you know, we're talking phase noise that, you know, 5 or 10 kilohertz away is minus 120, minus 130 decibels below the level of the carrier for the local oscillator. And we go, well, that's way, way down there. Your ear's not going to hear that. Well, and then they started describing things a little differently to me. One of the guys said, I said, what bands are you on? They said 80, 160, so on, 40. And then I started noticing a lot of the guys I were talking to with this were in the southeast, especially where you get a lot of, and also in Texas in that area, where you get a lot of thunderstorms and during thunderstorm season. And then one of the guys where it really turned a light bulb on said, hey, I'm not hearing the static crashes as loud with this new synthesizer. He had just taken, actually in a K3, he had switched it back and forth. And I go, really? And I thought about it a little bit, and then I realized what was happening. A static crash from a lightning strike somewhere in the distance, and it could be miles and miles away, is like having a million transmitters all transmitting every frequency, right? Well, think about that, and all that mixing with the little residual noise from your off your frequency, from your local oscillator, and all of a sudden, kablam! It raises your noise floor even more if that, you know, oscillator has that much noise, and all radios have some noise, so that's always some small component. But when we took it down as dramatically as we did between the K3 and the K3S, for those guys, all of a sudden some of these guys started saying, hey, I can hear more signals because the static crashes aren't covering them up. And that was an eye-opener. I hadn't even thought of that when we designed it. And then, well, that was a neat deal. So some of it, you get good things you don't even design for. But
So what they're really seeing is this really broadband noise from all these different sources kind of mixing and just raising the entire noise floor of the band.
Noise floor of the radio. Yeah. And so that can start to cover up the weak signals you're listening to.
Yeah.
But, you know, this all sounds scary. What do I do? How do I pick a radio now? Guys, most radios are going to be fun no matter what you do. If you start pushing the envelope, then some of this becomes more and more important. So I wouldn't panic over it. But you will notice it. You put a K3 a lot of people just notice a K3, for instance, or a K3S. They'll say, hey, it's really quiet on the band relative to some other radio they had. And all things being equal, we hope that's because we did a good job with all these things we're talking about.
You know, I think you made a really good point there, because you ever played around with photography at all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do you remember in the transition to digital cameras, especially kind of in the mid-2000s, where it started to become a race for pixel density, and you'd go buy that brand new Canon or Nikon, and you know take a picture with your finest glass, and you bring it up, and you start peeping at the pixels, and you really start getting into specs, which at the end of the day doesn't really matter for probably 95% of the pictures you're going to take. You know, you're talking about extremes of performance, and I think that thing that you just said is, you know, guys, don't get too hung up on this, because just modern receiver design overall is a lot better than it used to be, and there's a lot of great radios out there.
Oh, I agree, and I think, you know, obviously as you get into ham radio, being able to either move up through radios or improve your radio, that's one of the things we try to do, is let you improve the radio, so you can get there incrementally one way or the other. But one thing you mentioned on the photo thing was interesting. When they were going to all those higher pixels, they were also getting noisier initially. If you remember that,
they had those.
If you, especially in low light, you'd see that. And that was a new spec we all had to start paying attention to. It was, you know, so yeah, it's the same kind of thing. It start pushing the envelope a little more, and but you all of a sudden you found, hey, my pictures do look better if I get one that's got lower noise and higher pixel count. And
so exactly.
Of course, they had to fork out more money for those better cameras too.
Well, it's funny that that's pretty much true for all things. I'm sorry, George, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna try to get in one sort of deeper question. I apologize for the rattle, but since we're talking about dynamic range, there's a term that I think I've only heard in the last couple of years that I was hoping maybe Eric, you could explain what it is, and that is RMDR.
Yep, that's actually directly tied to phase noise.
Okay, could you tell us what that is? Because I all of a sudden people are using this phrase, and I can't even remember ever hearing it before, like a year ago. So, what is RMDR?
Yeah, reciprocal mixing dynamic range. There's going to be a test on this at the end of the show.
I'm taking notes.
You tell everybody that it's going to be an online test they have to take. But I won't be giving away a K3 at the end or K3S. But reciprocal mixing dynamic range is sort of the impact on receivers that how clean your oscillator is and how much noise your oscillator has that's being generated off the frequency you're tuned to. And again, almost all our oscillators are pretty quiet, but this particular test shows you how quiet they are. And the way it's run is again, you listen usually in a 500 hertz bandwidth for all these tests. I didn't say that earlier, but they're usually a fairly narrow bandwidth. And in the case of RMDR, what you do is you have a very clean oscillator. It could be a crystal oscillator or something that we know is a much cleaner than the radio we're testing. And we use that as a signal source. And there are some very clean oscillators that can be, you know, signal generators you can get that'll be useful for this also. But basically what you do is you measure, you determine how strong that signal has to be to start to raise the noise floor on the signal frequency you're tuned to. So say I'm tuned to 14000 and I've got that oscillator tuned to, say 5 kilohertz away, 14005. And I start turning it up from really weak to stronger and stronger and stronger. And again, it's quieter than what the radio is at. We make sure we have a very clean one. And as I have an attenuator on the output of it, and I start reducing the attenuation so it gets stronger in my receiver. Again, I'm not tuned to that frequency, so I shouldn't be hearing it. But all of a sudden, my noise floor is going to start getting louder. And when that noise floor goes up, and correct me, I mean, it's either 1 dB or 3 dB, and I'm sure someone will. I've forgotten here at the top of my head which one it is. But basically, as your noise floor on your frequency you're listening to goes up as a result of this strong signal, that's the point where we say, okay, the difference between what we had to set that signal level to and the noise floor of the radio, that dynamic range number, that's the reciprocal mixing dynamic range. And what that means is that strong signal is mixing with whatever residual noise is left on its frequency from my local oscillator to put them in my passband, because that's basically how it does work, either digitally or analog, where we have a local oscillator, we run it into a mixer, we add into that mixer the receive signal path, and you get some different frequencies out of that at whatever virtual IF we're using, either digitally or an analog, and have some narrow crystal filters then after that and so on. Well, if your local oscillator as a source has a lot of stuff that's not on its exact tune frequency, it's going to be like you're tuned to all those other frequencies, and if a strong enough signal is present there, that'll start creating it like it's on your frequency. So the cleaner your oscillator is off of your frequency, you get less noise on it, causes it to have lower noise side bands is the easiest way to look at it, the better a reciprocal mixing dynamic range you'll have. So that's hopefully not too techy for it. But the bottom line is bigger numbers are better, and good radios these days are like 110-115 dB reciprocal mixing. And as you get closer, that number is going to drop because the side bands from your local oscillator are always higher the closer you are to your oscillator frequency. So you'll see specs in the ARL. Here's RMDR at 2 kilohertz spacing, 5 kilohertz, 10 kilohertz, and so on. In essence, you're plotting the phase noise of your receive oscillator when you do that.
Okay. And does the phase noise of the transmitter, that would play into that, wouldn't it?
Well, in that test, that's what we make sure that, in this case, the transmitter or signal generator we're using as a step-in transmitter. You're talking about the one that's creating the interference. You want that?
Yes.
It's certainly your local oscillator also affects your transmit side. And in that case, the cleanliness of that's going to determine how broad a signal you have way down. And maybe doesn't matter if you're running 100 watts, if you're running 1500 watts, if you have a big antenna, it may be more important. Most radios are pretty good in that aspect. But when you're putting a lot of them close to each other, those of us that have exceedingly clean radios sort of excel in that and get used. You'll see them used on the expeditions a lot more together. You'll see them get used in contest stations and so on that way.
You know, I'm going to ask, this is going to be a reflection back of if I understood what you have said. And we did an episode a while ago about frequency standards and their uses in the shack for, you know, ganging things together to have the same standard. And of course, it's very common for people to acquire GPS discipline oscillators. And phase noise is one of the most important specs of these things. And, you know, you said earlier that phase noise is effectively, you know, measuring the jitter on the signal. And so I take that to mean that effectively phase noise is really a good indicator of how, I guess, precise that output signal is at whatever level.
Or how clean it is. Yeah, I think that's the best way. You know, think about it this way. If you have any amplification, anything with a transistor in it or you know, anywhere, or if your analog to digital converters are involved, anything else, they're all going to have some noise and distortion component they introduce. Well, in the case of a oscillator, again, think of it just wiggling infinitesimally back and forth from its center frequency as a function of this, you know, the thermal noise and things like that that naturally occur. And different designs, we can optimize them at different costs, of course, and get that lower. But it again, you can't get it cheaply usually. So the better ones tend to cost a little more that way, unless you're buying surplus on eBay. There's some really neat stuff out there for good price, but in terms of signal sources. But in terms of GPS stuff, you have to be careful in one area. And that is, some of those will actually make the phase noise of your radio worse, depending on how they interact and try to lock your radio to it. You'll actually end up, if you have a real quiet radio, sometimes an average GPS phase lock source, if it's not as clean as the radio, it'll actually make the radio a little bit noisier. So you have to be careful about that. Mm. So most of them are good enough. I mean, I wouldn't worry about it too much. You really don't care. But it's another one of those things. It's not just getting into specsmanship. It depends how you're using the radio.
So from a practical point of view, locking your radio equipment to a high accuracy frequency reference, it would not necessarily buy you any better performance.
Unless you're operating some modes where you have to be super locked on the same frequency with each other, some of the digital modes.
Yeah. These days. But as far as phase noise stability goes, that's probably not significant.
You're adding a lot more to the equation. It actually, the variables, I'm not saying you couldn't make it quieter, but I can tell you most of their ham radio design stuff, I don't know if it would make it quieter, make it more locked down in absolute frequency. But in terms of the phase noise component, might be a few dB worse, but it might not be at a level where you can hear the difference too. I mean, it's pretty slow.
So as a designer, manufacturer of this kind of gear, when you look at something like making a very low phase noise transmitter, do you look at that and see that to do it better is necessarily more expensive because you need different kinds of components or complexity of circuitry, or is it more just that you have a more clever design?
It's a combination, but I can tell you it does cost design time, which is dollars, testing time, and also manufacturing tests, making sure it really is still working.
Mm-hmm.
And the components are more expensive in some cases. Certainly, in a lot of the areas we've pushed the envelope on, it does require more expensive components, so it's quite a challenge sometimes. We might want to jump off this a little bit and just talk about some other things that are important on radio. I know we're getting low on time here probably, but... I had a couple of things I just wanted to mention really quick, and that is there's other things that make radios really useful. And, I mean, most radios have good sensitivity. Most radios have reasonably good dynamic range, but that's an area where we can, you know, push the envelope, and it's important to a lot of people. But other areas are, what are their key features in the radios? You know, obviously, pan adapters we've talked about in the past, and the ability to see weak signals on your pan adapters is a big deal. Not all pan adapters show you weak signals. But one of the really big ones is the diversity you're receiving, too. And this is something a lot of hams don't do or realize they could do. You can, even in a small city lot, use two antennas at once with some radios to listen on the same frequency, because the antennas are oriented slightly differently or at different heights. They can be wire antennas even. And you're tuned. Say you had two receivers locked exactly on the same frequency. You could then listen on both these antennas to that weak station you're trying to listen to, and depending on the angle their signal's coming in off the ionosphere and how each antenna is oriented, it might be fading out of one and fading into the other at the same time. And we call that diversity. We actually put it in one ear on each side if you get a second receiver in our radios. And that actually gives you a huge advantage, even more so than having a whole bunch more sensitivity sometimes. And things like that. There's lots of other features we can touch on, but things like pan adapters and obviously second receivers and doing diversity stuff is another key area outside of all this specsmanship stuff where you hear people talking about specs.
So, Eric, let's take a step back and look at the receiver architectures. And you had mentioned early on there's a couple different approaches to how you would do a receiver today. What are the top two or three receiver architectures, and what do you see as the differences in terms of what a user would perceive? What are the pros and cons?
Okay, well, I'd say that the top, say, call them direct, three commonly used receiver architectures are the classic superhet design, where you might, and this can be analog or a combination of analog and digital, where you convert from the frequency you're listening to, you mix it to another IF intermediate frequency, which may have some filtering. In some radios cases, they do that twice. They go to a high frequency and then a low frequency with filtering at each stage. And then they demodulate it afterwards. And then you've got direct conversion, where you directly take from your frequency you're listening to, say we're 14.2 megahertz is an example here. You're converting it down, in essence, down to what we call baseband, in essence, down to a zero IF almost. And that then is either demodulated in an analog case with a simple direct conversion radios we used to build years ago as kids, or goes directly into an analog to digital converter where you do that in DSP. And then you have direct sampling radios that have an analog to digital converter near the antenna that are directly sampling the frequency and then taking that and converting it from that frequency down to, if you might call it, a digital intermediate frequency or directly to digital baseband, depending on how they want to do their architecture inside and how they want to handle their filtering. And then you can do hybrids. The K3, for instance, and K3S are a hybrid of superhet, where we convert down to a first IF of 8.215 megahertz with a crystal filter that protects the analog to digital converter that follows it, that goes into our DSP for all the DSP demodulation and signal processing. And it converts, in essence, down to a lower frequency inside that DSP. So that's a hybrid there. The crystal filter actually protects us from overloading what the analog to digital converter can handle. That. That's why the K3S does so well, for instance, in blocking dynamic range. That said, you know, the direct sampling radios are coming close, but not in direct. In blocking dynamic range, they're still 10 or 15 dB below where we're at. But IM intermodulation, those do quite well. But the superhet designs overall work well, but I'd say I prefer the hybrid like we do it, or a direct sampling radio going forward. Now, there's one area, though, in terms of direct conversion that we did something sort of cool on the KX2 and the KX3. Both of those have an analog front end that converts the RF directly down, what we call baseband IQ. That are two signals that go into a couple of analog to digital converters right away and are then demodulated and processed by the digital signal processor. So there, and we actually can spit that IQ signal out the side of the radio in the case of the KX3 and to drive a pan adapter or other computers. People look at the signals on the, with a sound card on their computers and have a lot of fun processing them on their own, or running more pan adapters on their computer, things like that. But the one thing we did that was sort of cool there to get the performance up on the KX3 is we added what we called an IQ matched filter between where we converted down to baseband and it went into the analog digital converters. So sort of similar on a direct conversion case to what we did in the K3 in a superhead case. We had filtering in front of the A to D converters. In this case, a very tight analog filter, not crystal filter, that let us put a narrower passband, say a sideband or a CW passband, in front of the A to D converters when needed. To give you a little like, additional filtering and get more performance. In the case, ironically, the KX3 ended up much higher in the charts than anybody would have ever expected being compared. People even thought it beat the K3 because there was like a 1 dB difference in one spec. By the way, one thing I should say on specs, if you see 1, 2, or 3 dB difference between two radios, I can take three radios from any manufacturer and see that kind of variation. So don't pick one radio versus another based on a couple of dB difference. If you see 5 or 10, okay, you're starting to see a difference. But a couple, 2 or 3, is not enough. You couldn't hear it.
So one thing I noticed looking at some of these spec charts, like the Sherwood charts, the radios at the very top of the list that seem to be overall the very best receivers, they're an interesting mix of pure direct sample digital radios and hybrids like the Elecraft radios. And as you kind of go down the list, then they're of course the traditional superheads, but there's also SDR radios that don't hit the same performance numbers as the ones at the top. So I don't know if that's how much of that is due to the architecture or just the implementation or the sophistication of the devices, the components they used in the radios.
It's all of the above. The classic thing in the case of SDRs is how good is your analog to digital converter. Mm-hmm. If you have a military project, believe me, you can do an awful lot more because you're not as dollar constrained as we are in amateur radio. With how fancy of an analog to digital converter you do, that introduces less distortion, has a wider dynamic range, again, the ability to listen to weak signals and strong signals at the same time. A lot of people, that references to how many bits of conversion you can get out of it. Though, interestingly enough, that's not even a guaranteed good thing on a direct sampling radio or any DSP, because you also have to look at how much distortion that analog to digital converter, how linear it is. And there's a wide range. There's ones that claim to have a large number of analog to digital conversion bits to give you a wider dynamic range. But on the other hand, it's not perfectly linear between all those across its whole range. So, and all of a sudden you're losing something. So it's a, from a designer's standpoint, we have to look at a lot of things there from that way. But I'd say it's a combination of the quality of the analog to digital conversion and other components. Some obviously your design skills, how quiet your oscillators are, and even in digital stuff, oscillator, how clean they are makes a big difference for the DSPs. Obviously, how good your software is in a DSP, we all can do things differently there. In the case of, you have some older radios, the older classic super hits didn't focus on dynamic range as much as the newer ones have. So that's why you see a lot of them further down the charts. They were good radios. It's just, it was a different set of standards people were worried about back then and comparing them. But the, I'd say, again, all the radios are fun to use. I mean, you can take a 30-year-old radio and have a blast with it, and it's not going to, in most cases, be noticeable until you maybe put 3 or 4 of them next to each other and say, hey, this one's a lot quieter on 80 meters at night, and it's hearing the weak signals. Whereas the other one, it was hearing the weak signals, but it was maybe with a lot more noise around it, but you didn't notice it because you're having a lot of fun with the radio. So I wouldn't get super hung up on it, but if you, you're looking at radios, I'd say anything up in the upper charts of any of these comparison charts are pretty good. We like to think ours are some of the best, and we certainly push from that blocking dynamic range. That's a big deal because the SDRs haven't beat that yet. And so from a desense blocking dynamic range standpoint, we've got a 10 dB or better advantage. That's a 10 time stronger signal it takes to crunch our front end from just causing it to lose sensitivity than any other radio. So that's a big deal. That Sherwood chart is ranked actually on third order IMD, not on blocking dynamic range. You could actually reorder it. And we'd all shift a few spots, but actually, you'd still probably see the same top 10 radios up there for the most part.
So it seems like the radios in the top bin, the top 10 radios are Elecraft K3S, the high end flex radio systems like the 6700 or whatever. Maybe there's a newer one than that these days. The very top end ICOM like the 7850 series, 7851. So those are kind of swimming in the same circle of top level specs. If you were to sit down at each of those radios, would you say they're largely similar in performance from what the user would perceive?
They all have differences. It would be too long to get in here to all of them. I mean, there's neat things that they do with the SDRs. Flex makes great radios. I have no argument with that at all. As does ICOM and Yaesu and Kenwood. They're all good. And there's differences both in terms of how you use the radio. Some folks want to use them with a computer interface, or some folks want to use them with different types of processing on receive. And we do some different things in our DSP than what Flex or even ICOM would do in their DSPs. So we all have different ways of approaching different problems in there in terms of noise reduction, in terms of blanking, in terms of handling strong signals. I still think strong signal handling is important, so I don't think that ever goes away, but that becomes more at that higher end performance edge of the market. But I think they're all pretty good radios. I'm not going to say anything bad about anybody.
No, not at all. I mean, these are all at the peak, but I just find it interesting that of the top radios, they do have different architectures to achieve somewhat similar results.
Yeah. Well, they're similar. I think if you look at it, I think where the DSPs have excelled lately and gotten them up into that chart is by getting their intermod, their third order, where you have multiple signals mixing together and causing an intermod, interference on your frequency. They've gotten strong enough to say, hey, we're in the same ballpark, which is great. I think that was most important. And then when you start dealing with things like desense or blocking, where it takes a little bit stronger signal to do that kind of problem than what the intermod deals with, then that's where still some of the superheads and or hybrids like we are, where we're half superhead on the K3S and half SDR in the back end, or where we do like when the KX3, where it snuck up in the top 10 there in that table by taking a pure SDR direct conversion radio, but also putting some filtering right before the A to D that you could switch in. That allowed us to get there with that too. We just changed where the flexibility equation, you want to switch that in or out, you can have it both ways.
So it seems like from an engineering perspective going forward, one of the big challenges in a way is the skill set in the engineering team has to evolve, because in the old days, I guess we should call it a hardware defined radio, or a solder defined radio. I think Bill Mara on his podcast called it something like a solder defined radio. So in the good old days, it was more cleverness of circuit topology and component selection. And it seems like now, while that's still a factor, that there's this whole another world of signal processing software development skill set that your guys have to be able to not only implement these kind of features, but be able to do things even better than, just making it work. So is there a pretty significant need really for that kind of skill set, I would think, in the team?
Oh, absolutely. But surprisingly, that's been there for quite some time. We've been doing DSP work at that level easily for the last 10 years, because the same discipline in terms of a lot of the DSP processing we do was present in the back end of a K3 or K3S as it is in a full SDR, where you're doing it 100% inside the radio. We were doing the same, fast Fourier transforms, the same types of FIR and IIR filters that threw out some DSP terms, things like that, were all being coded even in our earlier radios. And of course, with the KX3 and KX2, they're doing everything in there. I mean, it's the whole shebang. So we had to evolve that. I think it's not something that most manufacturers are having to say, oh my gosh, I got to change something right now. Most of us actually have the skill set. We may be adding more people with that skill set, certainly, as we go forward. I think that'll happen a lot more. You're absolutely right there.
So this has been really helpful. I think going through all the specs at a detailed level, getting some notion of how you'd compare them has been helpful. Maybe we should kind of wrap this with some very practical advice. So, sure. So you've said several times that pretty much all of the radios from all the manufacturers out of the chute are good usable radios. It's not like, brand X makes clunkers. I mean, I've bought $500 radios and $3,000 radios, and there's a difference, but they're good for what they are. So if you're going to give out some advice, let's pick two hams. Let's say you've got a new ham who just passed his general license, wants to buy their first HF radio. What would you look for in your first HF radio?
Well, first of all, which one's going to be fun for you? Because each of us is going to have different needs for it. Some guys want to operate portable. Some guys want to operate from their ham radio shack in the basement. Some people want less knobs, are overwhelmed with all the choices, less choices. Some people want fancier ones. So that's each person's individual choice. But I think that, almost any radio you're going to get for your first ham radio, depends whether you feel like you want to have a radio that's going to last you 5 or 10 years, or you want to have one that you're going to upgrade from 3 or 4 years down the road, and maybe your level of comfort in the hobby increases, technically or just in terms of what you know you want to use it for. In the former case, if you're going to hold on to it for a while, you might want to get a radio that can expand into being a higher performance radio where you can add things to it. We certainly have done a lot in that area. if you're looking to maybe change radios and start with something even simpler and then change to a more, you know, fancier radio, who knows what we'll have in the next 5 years, right? And so you can go that route too. I certainly think that, you know, a lot of the radios are all good radios, and I think that if I say that, it's for different uses. Like, some radios are going to be great. There's like some lower end radios like the 7300 that have a small pan adapter in them. They do a good job with that. It's nothing wrong with that radio. It's not necessarily a high level contesting radio or field day radio necessarily for multi transmitter situations. But on the other hand, there's a ton of them out there. They're going to be great. I have one to play with. I buy one of almost every of our competitors' main radios coming out and personally use them before letting it go to somebody else, just to see what's out there. And I have fun with all of them. And I'm sort of anonymous and not talking about what radio I'm using when I have them on the radio, but I definitely want to see how they work and find out what's good. We try to, you know, but even for instance, if you bought a smaller radio that had a small pan adapter on its front screen, you might find, gee, I'm having trouble seeing the weaker signals with that just because of the size of the screen. And you move to a radio that's got a larger screen where you can add a pan adapter to it. So those are trade-offs there. And then the other question is, do you want to operate portable? Obviously, we target the KX radios. X is for extreme, so that was originally targeted at portable operation. But the KX3s evolved into the home station for a lot of people, so that covers a sort of expandable market. We can go both ways. But I'd say so for the basic guy just getting into it, you know, sometimes buying a used radio is not a bad idea either. Or getting one from a friend to play with. Because just like anything else, once you've used a radio for a while, you'll find what you like and don't like, and that'll inform you for what you're going to do for your next decision when you spend the real bucks on the next radio. For the higher performance guys, obviously you've got both the SDR radios and the hybrids like the K3S. And again, the back end of the K3S is as SDR as an SDR radio. We're doing all the same things in terms of how we signal process and demodulate. But we get some advantages in terms of performance the way we did it, both in terms of strong signal handling, like blocking, dynamic range. But on SDR, you've got some flexibility there too, because they're adding features to it that are unique to that SDR, and I think that's going to be fun too. So you're going to see strengths on both sides. And user interface, more knobs, more sort of a physical feel versus computer feel. Some folks want to go computer only. Some folks want to have a turn the radio on and not have to turn my computer on. So there's the trade-offs there.
My observation there is that things are kind of changing, and even in the like diehard original SDR products like the Flex radios, which was all computer user interface with their new Maestro control head and all that, it seems like they're well, of course, they still support a computer UI, that a lot of people want to use those radios with knobs and buttons. So and same thing with ICOM, you know, even though their new radios are all SDR based, but you would know, it works like a knob-based radio. So I think one thing that I've heard people say is, oh, SDR is when you're controlling your radio through the computer, which is like, no, not at all. I mean, it's like, you know, maybe 20 years ago, but not, you know, 15 years ago, but not now.
Yeah, all the radios are interfaceable to computers. You know, there's a number of apps that run with our radios. There's one neat one called Win for K3. Gosh, from the guys that are operating that, it's almost like you're in front of a computer all the time. You don't even have to touch the radio if you don't want to, but it does some really neat stuff. So yeah, you're right. You can interface them, but I wouldn't let the internal architecture be your only decision unless you want to learn about it. If you're into the technical side of it and you want to learn more about SDRs, pure SDRs, then go with a pure SDR, KX3 or Flex or any of the other ones, the Anons. You know, they're all, I think, interesting applications of a pure SDR approach.
Well, I think
they all have different use cases, obviously, in terms of size and everything else. But they're pretty fun. But in other hands, if you want, you know, analog radio, or you want a lot of knobs, you go that way.
So I think the knob count could be the same. The big difference to me is the SDR radios, or radios with an SDR significant component to the architecture, give you that much more latitude to upgrade and get modifications in the future if the vendor does that. So
that's a big if too, because we don't have any resources to all of us to do that. And also, you're going to find that actually there's hardware things. It's the analog never goes away, by the way, even in an SDR. If you look in the front of the transmitter section or the front end of the SDR, there's a lot of analog circuitry in there that has to be high quality or it's not going to be able to perform well.
Right.
So we all learn how to do all those things better over time, better parts, things like that. So I'd say, yeah, you're going to see things, but it's we've certainly done that with our like our KX line, where we've added all sorts of neat features in the SDR side that people asked for. So I'd say, yeah, I mean, that's not a bad reason to go that way.
So, Jeremy, I think we covered a lot of turf with Eric tonight. So is there anything else you can think of we should touch on before we go?
I mean, honestly, not really, because I've gotten one of the or several of the large questions that I've had for a long time around radio receivers answered. And actually, long before we were even at this point in the show, this was always something we had talked about. It's like, hey, we should reach out to Eric. You know, I think overall this is a pretty good introduction and just a good reinforcement of some of the things to keep in mind when selecting radios and specifically on the HF front. I don't know. I love my KX3. Thank you. Thank you for the KX3.
Okay, another vote. I love my KX3, my K3, my K2, my K1, my KX1. I have an embarrassment of Elecraft radios.
I didn't know you had that many radios, George.
I do. The first thing I built was my K2. By the way, one K2 assembly story that you'll appreciate. It was so long ago that I built my K2 that I remember flying to Japan on a business trip, and I'm winding those 19 freaking toroids while sitting on the airplane. I don't think that's something they would let you do anymore.
Probably not in the airplane. They'd think you were doing something rather strange. Lock you up.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, no, I've collected the whole herd. You know, I got to tell you, my main shack station radio here is K3, and I do cycle through other radios from time to time. And one thing, I'm not a big contester or anything, but as a sort of casual operator, I do notice that it is consistently lower noise coming out of the speaker. And if I hear a station on the other radio, whichever that happens to be, it always sounds as good or better on my K3. And I'm not just saying this because you guys are a sponsor. You're a sponsor because I can say this. So it's really kind of a pleasure to use. And I'm looking forward to field day. I've got my KX3 and my PX3 mounted in a little shelving unit thing. And I've been posting pictures of this on our Facebook page, so I should send you some shots so you can see what I've done with this. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to getting a chance to operate with that. So anyway, it's been great to have you on, Eric. Thank you so much for the time, and we would love to get you back for more.
Well, thanks very much, George and Jeremy. Hopefully, I didn't put anybody to sleep with all the receiver spec stuff. You're free to edit that down as much as you want.
Oh, don't worry. By this point in the show, we're probably about 2.5 hours in, and we've already done that ourselves.
Yeah.
Now, what about that DMR stuff?
Yeah. When is the KDMR4 coming out?
The KDMR4. I'm not liking it. I'm sorry, but stay tuned. There may be a KXDMR4. That'd be a riot if we didn't.
Did you hear that, Jeremy? He just announced.
That's what I said. I just tweeted it. And in fact, actually, we're going to see you in we're going to see you in 2 weeks at Dayton. So we'll
Dayton make or that's Visalia in 2 weeks, I think, right? Or
so when this airs, it'll be 2 weeks.
Ah, sorry about that.
Okay. No, that's okay. That's the beauty of podcasting. All the time shifting we get to do.
Okay. Well, fantastic.
Master of time and space. Thanks so much, Eric. Really appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
So we want to thank Eric again for taking the time to spend with us to walk us through that. I know that I came away from the conversation feeling like a far more informed consumer of pretty much any radio receiver that I would ever look at. And, you know, this doesn't just apply to the amateur gear you're picking up at HRO or ordering from Elecraft. You know, these receiver specifications are good, I mean, and helpful in understanding and evaluating any type of radio receiver.
And actually, having had this conversation about the receivers, there's so many other topics that it would be great to pick the brains of the Elecraft guys. And so we talked with Eric a bit about having more folks come on the show and talking about other topics, and they would very much like to do that. So we'll do more of this in the future.
All right. Well, as per usual, thank you very much for listening. We look forward to seeing as many of you as we can at Hamvention. Again, we are going to be at booth 3104. And as always, you can find us online at www.hamradioworkbench.com. You can find us on Twitter at HamWorkbench. And you can find us on Facebook by looking for the Ham Radio Workbench group.
Hey, Jeremy, you know, we crossed over the 500 mark on our Facebook page.
That is awesome. Actually, we also crossed over the 500 mark on our Twitter followers.
And maybe after Hamvention, we'll have at least one more.
Yeah, at least one. You know, I feel like we're forgetting something. I mean, we normally say, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at KF7IJZ.
And I normally say, if you want to follow me, I'm at KJ6VU.
Well, I really do feel like we're forgetting something, but, you know.
Maybe what we have another 2 or 3 hours we could talk about Phillips screwdrivers.
We could. Actually, I'm kind of surprised that wasn't going to be your topic at the forums.
Yeah, well, I'm saving that for next year. So what are we missing?
Oh, I know.
What?
We've been teasing for the last couple episodes that if you're the type of person that listens to the end, that there'd be some information for you.
And what would that be?
All right. So here's the deal. If you are listening to us right now and you are going to be at Hamvention, you have a very special opportunity. And that opportunity is we are going to be giving away 50 of the PowerPole strip boards for free.
50?
50. 50.
That's pretty nice.
That is pretty nice. All you have to do is come by the booth, and this is going to be first come, first serve. Once the first 50 are gone, then they will be available for sale again for $5 plus tax. But all you have to do is come by the booth and say, I listened to the end, and let us know that you heard this, and you will walk away with a shiny power pole board.
You want them to say, I listened to the bitter end?
Just acknowledge that you heard this.
Okay, just say, look, I'm the one person that actually listened to the end of the show, so I deserve the board.
Again, we will have 50 of those to give away, first come, first served. But that might not be enough.
But wait, there's more?
Yeah, I think we're going to do something else. So that's great for the first 50 people that come up. We're going to actually do another giveaway.
What's that?
We're going to give away one of everything that we brought to sell.
Like what?
Well, so that's going to be the Smarty and Dummy Load boards. That's going to be the Power Pole board. And that is going to be the coax relay kit.
Wow. So that's the relay board.
The relay board and the pick. Yes, not the whole kit. So we're going to give a set of those away also to a listener. But this one's going to be a little more challenging.
Okay. How?
So we've got two trivia questions for the diehard fans of the show.
And what's trivia question number one?
Well, so there's a trivia question about me, and there's a trivia question about you. So I'm going to tell them my trivia question, and then you tell them your trivia question.
All right.
Okay. So for me, my call sign is KF7IJZ. Where did I get my call sign?
You mean physically, where did you get your
I've mentioned
license?
Several times on the show why I have a 7 call sign.
Ah.
So if you can remember what that is or go back and find it, and you're the first one to get to us, you might walk away with the whole kit and caboodle. You know, I just realized if there are two questions, we should probably do more than one giveaway.
Well, you have to give away one set of boards to each winner.
Yeah. All right, so then we'll do another one if you can answer George's. And sorry, if you answer both, you still only get one.
Right. So we have two winners, one on your trivia question and one for mine. My trivia question is, my ham radio club here in the Bay Area has an annual radio conference in January. What's the name of the conference?
There you go.
That's it?
That's it. So if you're the first person to come to our booth and answer those questions, then you'll walk away with a little prize pack.
Yeah, and you get home and you can build your new workbench just like yours and actually solder that stuff together.
Well, folks, we are super excited about seeing you in Xenia, Ohio in less than 2 weeks. Please absolutely stop by, say hello, tell us about what you're working on. Our favorite part about this whole thing is getting to spend time with you.
That's right. And we can't wait to hear about your projects. And you could become nerd famous, too.
Yes, you could. So thanks all again for listening. And we will talk to you again in episode 50, 73.
73s.